Don't assume too much. Well, I've been researching the book for about 10 years, and really only the last 2 or 3 years full-time researching and writing, and went to archives all over the country, spent a lot of time in California, interviewed several dozen people. So it really was a tremendous amount of work.
What's interesting in the book, of course, is not the campaign alone, but the fact that you deal with everyday life in 1934, the people and the places and the things that happened. You must have scoured microfilm.
Well, I went through the daily newspapers of all the leading California newspapers, plus the New York Times and of course, magazines and so forth. So in doing that, since the book is in a day-by-day account of the last 2 months of the campaign, I tried to give it the flavor of what was going on in the country then. And, of course, like today, it was a very dramatic time. It was in the depths of the Depression, and people were looking for a solution to terrible economic problems. They were looking for someone to sort of ride in on the white horse and solve problems, maybe an outsider, someone who was not in politics before. And, there are certain parallels to today, you might say.
Yeah, there really are, although, of course, Sinclair was a radical. We think of Ross Perot as the Sinclair-like candidate today, but they're certainly not alike at all. People looking for a solution or someone to come in and say, save us from what's happening.
Well, the ideology is different, but what went into Sinclair's campaign was similar in the sense that it really was a spontaneous movement. It was a grassroots organizing. It was people all over California who suddenly got together and in their own communities and created a movement, which is what Perot has done. And it's it could not probably happen with a real politician, and it would have to be a real outsider, someone who was famous in another field, someone who seemed like they really could come in out of nowhere and shake things up. So I think it's quite similar in many, many ways.
Yeah, and there are other characters, not unlike Sinclair, different in philosophy, of course, but people looking for, in a way, utopian answers. There's Huey Kingfish Long and Dr. Edward Townsend. Was it Edward Townsend?
Right.
Edward Townsend,
right.
And Father Coughlin.
Right. Right.
All of these people were those that Americans kind of turned to say, help us, help, do something, because they took rather radical positions.
Right. Well, everyone back then had a plan. Even entertainers like Charlie Chaplin were very interested in the economics, and they had their own plan. And Upton Sinclair really almost came to power on the basis of a plan. He had a plan that would give everyone in California a job, would provide pensions to the elderly, and they would heavily tax the rich. So it was kind of a Robin Hood sort of thing. But it was a real plan, and we're starting to see a little bit more of that today. Instead of people just throwing up their hands and saying we don't have the money to do anything, all of the candidates are now being forced to come up with some kind of a solution to the problems we seem to have today.
Well, let's go back a little bit. Who was Upton Sinclair?
Well, most people have heard of him because in high school everyone is taught about the great muckrakers of the turn of the century who exposed all sorts of social ills. And Upton Sinclair wrote the book The Jungle, which was about the meatpacking industry in Chicago and how the terrible things that were happening in our meat. For most people, he then disappears from their minds. But actually, he lived for another 60 years. He wrote dozens of well-known books. He was a tremendously famous and controversial figure in his time. And so when he ran for governor in 1934 as a Democrat and actually swept the Democratic primary in a landslide, people all over the country almost went berserk. Because this guy was known as a controversial figure, sort of a left-winger, someone who was, even his enemies loved him as a person. He was a wonderful, wonderful figure, but he was known as something of a rabble-rouser. So when he captured the Democratic nomination, literally the whole country, including President Roosevelt and William Randolph Hearst and the people in the movie industry and so forth, really almost fainted. And set in motion what I call the birth of media politics.
Now, you also point out in the book that forever Upton Sinclair was confused with Sinclair Lewis.
Right. Well, Sinclair Lewis was admittedly a better writer. He was, of course, the famous novelist. He won the Nobel Prize and so forth. And he was more of a literary figure. But Upton Sinclair was more of a political muckraker.
How did it happen that Upton Sinclair developed a kind of a utopian political view? Didn't he have a sort of a commune complex on the Hudson River in New Jersey at one point?
Well, it was called Helican Hall, and actually he built it with the proceeds from the jungle and started a commune there with Sinclair Lewis, actually was part of it. And there was a mysterious fire one night, and it burned to the ground, and that was the end of that experiment. But Sinclair was very consistent throughout his life. He believed in taxing the rich and giving to the poor. And of course, when he won the Democratic nomination in 1934, the what you might call the establishment or the power structure in California really was scared, and set this chain of events in motion that really gave us the political campaign as we know it today.
Was Upton Sinclair a socialist?
He was a socialist most of his life, and he had run for office previously on the Socialist Party line. And what happened in 1934, it was, he said, you know, the Socialist Party, it's just a protest vote, I'm going to run to win. And so he joined the Democratic Party, ran as a Democrat, and swept the party primary. So it'd be sort of be like if Ross Perot this spring had sort of said, you know, we have to get rid of President Bush, I'm going to run as a Democrat, and swept to the Democratic nomination. And so this, sort of the same thing happened back then.
But in effect, he did develop a party, didn't he, called EPIC, Ending Poverty and...
End Poverty in California, EPIC, right.
Yeah.
Well, it wasn't really a party, but it was a movement. That was the name of his social movement that swept him to the nomination. And it was a grassroots organization with hundreds of thousands of average people working in their communities and forming probably the most remarkable social movement, certainly in the history of California, and one of the most remarkable in the country.
Well, it certainly put the Democrats in a dilemma, especially Franklin Roosevelt. Here was a guy who... certainly was a socialist. Roosevelt was having his own problems being labeled as a liberal. So how did the Roosevelt administration react to the candidacy of Upton Sinclair?
Well, as you say, they were in a difficult position because Roosevelt was already being called a socialist, and a lot of people saw him as far left. And, of course, many liberals thought he wasn't moving fast enough. The New Deal had just begun and really was not having that much impact yet. And so people on the left said he was moving too slow, and people on the right said he was moving too fast. So here was Upton Sinclair winning the Democratic nomination, and there was just tremendous amount of pressure on Roosevelt to support the nominee of his party, where others said, geez, if you support someone who's a former socialist, that's going to kill you the rest of your term. So he was really in a difficult spot, and I think one of the most interesting things in the book is I really, really cover in a day-by-day way these pressures on Roosevelt and his twists and turns. It seemed that at some points he promised to endorse Sinclair, and then he withdrew that. Then it looked like he was going to endorse him again, and then he pulled back from that. And in the end, he ended up actually working for the election of Sinclair's Republican opponent, who was a right-wing reactionary. So it was kind of shocking to see Roosevelt swing all the way over there, but it really makes for fascinating reading, I think.
Upton Sinclair launched his gubernatorial bid actually with a pamphlet or a book, didn't he?
Right. It was called I, Governor of California and How I Ended Poverty. And it was a sort of fanciful look into the future about how a famous writer named Upton Sinclair runs for governor and wins the election. And actually abolishes poverty in California in his first term. And then he retires from office and returns to writing novels. And it really captured the imagination of the California public and became the best-selling book in California. And, he decided to try to put his fantasy into operation. And it was... excuse me. It was quite a novel approach and quite successful.
Was EPIC a practical economic plan, or was it indeed Upton Sinclair's fantasy?
Well, many disagree on which side that it really goes on there, but It's sort of like in politicians today, you sort of state your principles, you say what you'd like to do, and then once you get a nomination, you start to compromise, you start to move towards the center. And certainly this is what Sinclair did. By the time the real election campaign came along, he was calling himself a New Deal Democrat, completely in step with Franklin Roosevelt and so forth. So even if he had won the election, I'm sure he just would have been perhaps a more liberal version of Franklin Roosevelt, but they never would have been able to put into practice his entire program.
You touched on some of the elements of his program. Can you be a little more specific about what it would have done?
Well, besides, now this was before Social Security, so the fact that he promised pensions for the elderly and the needy was quite significant. It wasn't going on at that time. But probably the centerpiece of his platform was, I think maybe many people nowadays are familiar with the concept of a co-op. Sometimes it's just co-op groceries or grocery stores or whatever. But basically what he proposed was that he would take over farmland, which had been foreclosed by the banks, and put thousands of people to work, working in the agricultural fields. And he would take over factories, which had shut down during the Depression, and have thousands of people there making the necessities of life, mattresses and clothing and furniture and so forth. And the people who worked in the factories would trade what they made for the food from the farmlands. And so you'd have this almost a cooperative, separate economic system within the state that would take care of the needs of the half a million or a million people who were on relief.
Sounds like a nightmare to administrate.
Well, it probably would have been, and they would have had to raise taxes a great deal to make it work. But, you have to remember this was in the depths of the Depression. People had no jobs. They had many weren't even getting relief. Many did not really have food for their tables. You sort of have to look at today's economy and, multiply it by about five times worse. And you can imagine that for hundreds of thousands of people, Upton Sinclair became the Messiah.
Well, the movie industry reacted badly to the candidacy of Upton Sinclair. Tell me about that.
Today, we tend to associate Hollywood with kind of a liberal bias, you might say. But back then, all of the movie moguls were conservative Republicans. And so naturally, they were opposed to Upton Sinclair, who they saw as a fire-breathing radical who wanted to tax the studios and tax their own wealth. And so when he won the Democratic nomination, they sort of enacted a widespread strategy to totally destroy him. The first thing they did was they threatened to move the studios to Florida. This was supposed to scare people throughout California into voting against Sinclair. Well, most people didn't take that seriously. So then the next step, which was concocted by Louis B. Mayer of MGM, was to dock every single worker in Hollywood from star to screenwriter to makeup man, one day's pay that would go into the campaign chest of Sinclair's opponent. So no matter who you were, you'd get your weekly paycheck and there'd be one day's pay missing. As a sort of a forced donation to defeat Sinclair.
How could that be legal?
Well, back in those days, things were a little more wide open than they are now. Plus, the studio bosses were tremendously influential. No one was going to stop them from doing anything. And nearly everyone went along with it. Even many famous stars and directors like Frank Capra and Shirley Temple even was photographed delivering her one day's pay to the Republicans. Jimmy Cagney was one person who objected. In fact, he told them that if they asked him again to give one day's pay against Sinclair, he was going to donate 1 week's pay to Sinclair. So that kind of shut them up for a while. But so that was the second phase, and that raised an enormous sum of money. The third phase, which was created by of all people Irving Thalberg, who is this tremendously revered figure, the famous MGM producer, was to, for the first time, use the screen against a political candidate in America. propaganda films were being made in Germany by Adolf Hitler, but the screen had never been used against a candidate in America. So what he did was he formed a little film unit which made a series of movie shorts which were shown in theaters throughout California. And these were propaganda films. I call them the first attack ads, the precursor of the Willie Horton ad and the horrible attack ads that we see today and on television. And these just pictured Upton Sinclair as a horrible communist who was inviting communists and criminals and hobos to California to take over the state. And they were tremendously effective because the movie audiences were used to sort of nonpartisan newsreels and so forth on the screen. So when they saw these movie shorts, they thought they were really documentaries. And so really for the first time, the movie industry took part in politics in America. So even on that level, it was a tremendously significant campaign.
Well, and there's another element, too. That was the first full-fledged public relations campaign, mm-hmm. I believe headed by a man named Whitaker.
Well, I called the book The Campaign of the Century because, I mean, obviously it was not the most significant campaign in terms of national policy or anything like that. But I call it The Campaign of the Century because it really introduced the modern political campaign to America. All campaigns since then owe a debt, you might say, to this campaign. And what happened essentially was that the powers that be in California, after Sinclair won the Democratic nomination, decided that they could not trust defeating him to the Republicans. The Republican Party itself was really weak. So for the very first time, they went outside the party structure to hire freelance public relations men, advertising experts, political consultants, and employing Hollywood as well. And this, of course, we all take this for granted now. And these people now have names like handlers and spin doctors and things worse than that, I guess. But back then, that had never been done before. And the reason was is that Upton Sinclair was seen as such a threat, he simply had to be defeated. And they couldn't trust the Republican Party to the job, so they, for the very first time, they went outside the party structure and hired the people we now call media manipulators.
Now, in the book, and you have quite a number of pictures, there was such a heat campaign with pamphlets and posters and this sort of thing, phony money. Tell me about that.
Well, it was really hard, the dirtiest campaign of our time. Partly because there were so many front groups and groups that were not controlled by the Republican Party who were out there raising money and raising cane and distributing all sorts of pamphlets and doing all sorts of dirty tricks and using radio as it had never been used before, putting up tens of thousands of billboards. It was wild, and I think... you read the book now, and I think it's extremely entertaining. It's very often very funny. It's outrageous, but that's kind of in retrospect. At the time, it was deadly serious, and really was employed to destroy this candidate. But it does make for very entertaining reading now. But the many of the dirty tricks and media tricks and manipulations that we see today really came out of this campaign.
And what was Upton Sinclair doing to try to counter all of this?
Well, he didn't have the money to respond. He didn't, since this was a brand new type of campaign, he really didn't know what he was up against, really. This really had never happened before. And he was a very polite gentleman, very soft-spoken, not the rabble rouser that people would envision from his politics, and he just felt that the best thing was just to keep doing what he was doing, and that this popular movement would carry him to victory. And in the end, he fell a little bit short. The smear campaign and the media campaign that was invented during this race was victorious. And Sinclair never ran for office again, and I guess it's no wonder he didn't.
Well, it was victorious, all right, but it looked like Upton Sinclair was really going to be trounced at the polls, but it wasn't quite like that, was it?
No, he got he lost by a couple hundred thousand votes. He got almost a million votes, which was a tremendous vote in California at the time. It was double the vote any Democrat had ever gotten in California. And the really the influence of this race, beyond what we've already talked about in terms of the media politics, was that it sort of permanently created a liberal Democratic Party in California. It permanently brought Hollywood into politics. The sort of the liberals in Hollywood were so outraged by this campaign that they started organizing, and this liberal bias that many people complain about nowadays really was born in response to this campaign. And Sinclair's Great Social Movement also influenced President Roosevelt to move faster on Social Security and the WPA and various jobs programs. So it did have a tremendous effect. So some might say the creation of the modern media campaign was such a negative contribution that outweighs everything else. But there were so many things that came out of this campaign that I think the title, "The Campaign of the Century," is justified.
As Ruckman Sinclair, after his defeat, the first thing he did was go back to his typewriter.
Right. Well,
what did he write?
He wrote a book called "I Candidate for Governor and How I Got Licked." And he described in great detail some of the dirty tricks used against him and sort of what he went through. And what was funny about it was that many of the newspapers, which had attacked him in these incredible smears throughout the campaign, then paid him to use excerpts from the book. They thought it was all great fun. Now that he'd been defeated, he was no longer a threat, so they wanted to take advantage of his fame, and so they ran excerpts from his book on their front pages. And Hollywood, which had just killed him, approached him to make a movie about him. So it was kind of a wacky race. I mean, it was a wonderful book to write and research because there were so many wacky elements to it, so many celebrities involved. Practically anyone who was anyone back in those days was involved in, you know, one way or another. And it was really a delight to research and write. And it was really a wild campaign.
Well, that was 1934, but Upton Sinclair had a long career still ahead of him, didn't he? What happened to him after that election campaign?
He never ran for office again. He started to pull out of politics entirely. And throughout the 1940s and 1950s, he wrote a series of best-selling novels with kind of more of a gentle socialistic viewpoint, you might say. And he remained active as a writer practically up until his death, which was in the late 1960s. So he really had a long, amazing, controversial, productive life. And the epic campaign sort of lives on today in many of the influences that came out of it.
If we kind of touched on this at the beginning of the conversation, but if Sinclair had been elected, do you think he would have been able to apply his programs?
Right. Well, this is another comparison with Ross Perot today. If Perot was elected, would he be able to work with Congress? Would he be able to get anything through, or would he just sort of be a figurehead? And I guess one response to that is to say, well, figureheads can get a lot done, you know, just from their the way they can set the national agenda and speak to the people and so forth. So it's hard to say. I don't think Sinclair would have been able to enact very much of what he was for, but I think he would have really kind of wrenched California into the 20th century. And, if Perot is elected, we'll see what happens there. But there really are a lot of connections with Perot in the media sense also. In many ways, Perot is the culmination of the media politics which began in this race. He's sort of the first all media candidate. His entire campaign has been conducted through the media, and people are afraid that he's going to buy up all the media time and overwhelm the other candidates. On the other hand, he has pledged never to run an attack ad, never to run negative advertising. So which also was invented during the Sinclair race. So in that sense, he wants to put a stop to the horrible things that came out of that. So it really will be interesting to see how it plays itself out. And in one sense, Perot is the represents the worst aspect of media politics, and in another sense, he'll be a break on some of the worst excesses.
How did it happen that you became interested in this campaign and in Upton Sinclair?
I just read a little bit about it and was amazed at the cast of characters involved. I was amazed, as most people are today, when they first hear about the book and they say, gee, Upton Sinclair ran for governor? I had the same reaction myself. And I read about the Hollywood's involvement and Irving Thalberg and these movie shorts. And I said, geez, I wonder if anyone's ever done a book about it. And, of course, no one had. And I was kind of surprised about that, too. So I just thought the elements that were involved, this combination of politics, Hollywood, literary figures, a lot of sort of outrageous humor, was just an irresistible combination.
What is your own background?
Well, I've written other books. I've been a journalist, magazine editor. I've written other books about sort of social issues and so forth. But I'm not a trained historian or so forth. And I think to that extent, it's helpful in the book because I think the book is extremely readable. It doesn't have a kind of a academic stodginess that many such political histories have.
And I think there are no footnotes, for example. Plenty of notes in the back of the book.
Right. But it's a very it makes it for a very readable book. Yet I did a tremendous amount of research. So I mean, I like to think that it combines the best elements of scholarly research with sort of a very readable, almost novelistic kind of text, because it does have all this incredible cast of characters who are mixed together, and I think it does read to some extent like a novel.
It does read like fiction. It reads like a story, and it's
hard to believe. So it's
long. It's a big book. It's more than 600 pages. So, but it's actually a fast read, because you break up. All of the episodes into small hunks,
right.
So
mm-hmm.
that you're not bogged down with pages of black text. And so it reads fast, and there are so many interesting people. Will Rogers is all through the book, and Charlie Chaplin, and on and on and on.
The reason there's so many of these famous characters involved is partly because of the notoriety of the campaign. Everyone had some reaction to it. Again, it's very similar to what's happened with Perot just in the last couple of weeks. Suddenly, when Perot went to the top of the polls, people stopped talking about, that Perot was going to fade away or he was just a flash in the pan, and everyone started taking him seriously. And now everyone is talking about Perot. Well, the same thing happened when Sinclair won his nomination. Everyone from H.L. Mencken to William Randolph Hearst and Ezra Pound put their two cents in, and many of them even came to California to cover the race. And then the other reason was that Sinclair had such a diverse background that he had friends in politics, friends in literary field, friends in Hollywood, even friends in the White House. So it just involved this incredible collection of characters.
Terrific book, Campaign of the Century, Upton Sinclair's Race for Governor of California and the Birth of Media Politics by Greg Mitchell. Greg, thank you very much.
I'm happy to be here.